friends, I am really serious today about us getting really serious about the serious things that really matter.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I want to encourage you to put on your spiritual seatbelts because we are going to get moving today, and I believe your hearts will be stirred. If you don't consider yourself a Christian, you don't consider yourself a follower of Jesus, well, by all means, keep listening, keep watching. But in particular, I want to speak to those of us who say that we know the Lord, we are His children, we are His followers. 866-34-TRUTH is another call, 866-348-7884. So every night I consider which direction we're going to go on the broadcast for the next day. If I don't have a guest and a subject already lined up, I'm thinking about it. Sometimes it's very obvious, it's clear, something major in the news I need to speak about. Sometimes it flows out of an article that I write. Last night, I was praying. I had a bunch of different things in my heart, but I was stirred. I was stirred about the need for us to be more serious before God, stirred about just the one opportunity that we have here in this world, in the light of eternity, to glorify the Lord, to make a difference, to make our lives count. And it doesn't mean you can't sit down with your family and have fun. It doesn't mean you can't just relax and chill, but it means the overall course of our lives is lived with a sense of fire, with a sense of passion, with a sense of dedication, with a sense of commitment, with a sense of earnestness. So I want to share some things with you. I want to play some clips for you with the hope that they will ignite a deeper fire, passion, hunger, desire in your heart that will cause you to say with the psalmist in Psalm 40, here I am. With Isaiah in Isaiah 6, here I am, send me. That we'll be better able to relate to the words of Jesus in Luke 12 when he said, I've come to cast fire on the earth and how consumed I am, I'm straitened until it happens. Listen to what Leonard Ravenhill said. Leonard Ravenhill, great revivalist, great man of prayer, most famous for his book, the first of several books, Why Revival Tarries. I had the privilege of being very close with him the last 5 years of his life from 1989 to 1994 when he died at the age of 87. This is what Leonard Ravenhill once said, and this is how he lived. He said, when will we get serious about getting serious about the most serious thing in the world? Let me repeat that. When will we get serious about getting serious about the most serious thing in the world? In the preface to my book, Whatever Happened to the Power of God, which came out in 1991, I wrote these words. This is 1991. While the American church celebrates, our beloved country sinks into lower and lower depths. We are not only killing unborn babies, but we've begun to kill helpless adults, actually starving them to death. It is claimed that some of them are in a persistent vegetative state. I believe it is the church that is in a persistent vegetative state. Will nothing awaken us from our stupor? Now, friends, remember, this is 1991. I wrote this when I lived in Maryland. I'm ashamed to think of the fact that Maryland, where my family and I now live, has just passed the country's most liberal abortion law. I am angered when I recall that New York City, where I was born, recently lit up the Empire State Building in lavender in honor of gay pride, 1991. I'm embarrassed when I consider that the, quote, spirit-filled Church of America, of which I'm a part, has a reputation for carnality, flakiness, and exaggerated hype, a reputation largely deserved. I am chastened when I read the results of a recent Roper poll indicating that most born-again believers fall into more sin after their conversion than before their conversion. And then I ask these questions. Where is the purity of the gospel? Where are the true disciples? Where is the power of God? And I said there are no easy answers to these questions, but there are answers. May the Lord give us ears to hear. It will be worth it in the end. Oh, for a glorious church. You know, some years back, my wife Nancy went through a deep personal transformation in the Lord as a believer when she determined to seek Him with all of her heart and thought, all of my heart means all of my heart. And she gave the whole thrust of her life to going after God, and He met her and changed her. I've had times in my life of seeking Him earnestly, but not on the level she did, and I encountered Him in a deeper way, and it changed me. As believers, we should have ongoing transformation, not just day by day, week by week, year by year, that someone who hasn't seen us in years is around and say, wow, you're really different. You seem much more compassionate. Well, that's wonderful. I mean, that's how most growth and most change takes place, right? Day by day, little by little, imperceptibly. But then we need to look at our lives. We realize that the whole course of my life itself, I've left my first love, the passion, the fire, the hunger, the burden for the lost, the burden for the glory of God to be manifest, the burden to see God come and touch people, the burden for deeper intimacy with Him, greater love for the Word, greater love for my neighbor. It's not there. And it produces a kind of crisis. And out of that crisis, our hearts are stirred. And this pushes us to go after God. I want to play some clips for you. First, from Leonard Ravenhill, talking about eternity. He used to pray the prayer of Jonathan Edwards, who prayed, stamp eternity on my eyes. Maybe Ravenhill's most famous quote, this question, are the things you're living for worth Christ dying for? And he would often preach on the judgment seat of Christ and daily meditate on the fact that we will one day stand before Him and give account. Listen to what Brother Len had to say.
Oh God, stamp eternity on my eyeballs. But you know, if God should stamp eternity or even judgment on our eyeballs, or if you like, on the fleshy table of our hearts, I'm quite convinced we'd be a very, very different tribe of people, God's people in the world today. We live too much in time, we're too earthbound. We see as other men see, we think as other men think. We invest our time as the world invests it, we invest our money. We're supposed to be a different breed of people. I believe that the Church of Jesus Christ needs a new revelation of the majesty of God. They're all going to stand one day. Can you imagine it? At the judgment seat of Christ, to give an account for the deeds done in the body. This is what? This is the King of Kings. And He's the Judge of Judges. And it's the tribunal of tribunals. And there's no court of appeal after it. The verdict is final. Listen, when you see Jesus, you're not going up and say, hey, buddy, I'm glad you died for me. When you see Jesus, you'll be almost paralyzed with fear unless you have a glorified body and a glorified mind.
Sobering thoughts. Not that we will be judged and cast into hell for our sins if we are believers washed with the blood of Jesus, but we will give account to God. That's an intense concept. Read Romans 14. Read 2 Corinthians 5. It's clearly laid out in all the parables of Jesus about the talents and things like that and giving account for our lives. We will give account. Again, I ask you to consider what Leonard Ravenhill asked. Are the things you're living for worth Christ dying for? Right now, as our world is so different than we've ever seen it with the shutdown and the pandemic and all of that, it's a time to be asking deeper questions. And what about the condition of our heart? Is there brokenness? Is there pain for a dying world? Is there a burden? I'm not trying to lay a guilt trip. I'm trying to do an analysis, a diagnosis, like a spiritual doctor giving you a checkout. And a checkup. And I've done it in my life over and again, not in self-condemnation, but self-examination so as to grow and so as to be realistic and so as to not to deceive myself, because I understand I could deceive myself just as easily as I could deceive someone else. Listen to what David Wilkerson had to say. I had the privilege of spending many hours with him preaching at Times Square Church 40 or 50 times, and then before the meeting or after, getting to chat with him and sometimes some serious face-to-face. What he's talking here about is something that he lived. What's happened to the burden of the Lord in our lives? Listen to him.
And I look at the whole religious scene today, and all I see are the inventions and ministries of man and flesh. It's mostly powerless. It has no impact on the world. And I see more of the world coming into the church and impacting the church rather than the church impacting the world. I see the music taking over the house of God. I see entertainment taking over the house of God. An obsession with entertainment in God's house, a hatred of correction and a hatred of reproof. Nobody wants to hear it anymore. Whatever happened to anguish in the house of God? Whatever happened to anguish in the ministry? It's a word you don't hear in this pampered age. You don't hear it. Anguish means extreme pain and distress. The emotion so stirred that it becomes painful. Acute, deeply felt inner pain because of conditions about you, in you or around you. Anguish. Deep pain. Deep sorrow. Agony of God's heart.
Friends, what happened to the burden? What happened to the tears? What happened to sharing God's heart? We sow with tears, we reap with joy. And then these words from missionary pioneer C.T. Studd, who ultimately gave his life for the people of Africa, left the riches of England. It's not a sin to be rich, but he felt the calling, he felt the burden to live in light of eternity. This is not him speaking, but these are his words. Let's listen.
Too long have we been waiting for one another to begin. The time for waiting is past. The hour of God has struck. War is declared. In God's holy name, let us arise and build. The God of heaven, he will fight for us, as we for him. We will not build on the sand, but on the bedrock of the sayings of Christ, and the gates and minions of hell shall not prevail against us. Should such men as we fear? Before the whole world, yes, before the sleepless, lukewarm, faithless, namby-pamby Christian world, we will dare to trust our God. We will venture our all for him. We will live and we will die for him. And we will do it with his joy unspeakable, singing aloud in our hearts. We will 1,000 times sooner die trusting only in our God than live trusting in man. And when we come to this position, the battle is already won, and the end of the glorious campaign in sight. We will have the real holiness of God, not the sickly stuff of talk and dainty words and pretty thoughts. We will have a masculine holiness, one of daring faith and works for Jesus Christ.
We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Phone lines are open, and I'll be getting to your calls in a while. On any subject, you can say amen to what I just said, or ask me how do we get more serious, or you can have a general Bible question, or something going on in politics and culture. This is Live Talk Radio, so we will get to your calls shortly. Also, tomorrow, I'm going to be joined by some special guests, longtime colleagues over 20 years working together. They head up our missions program, and you're going to be stirred. You're going to hear some amazing, wonderful, Jesus-glorifying stories and find out about how perhaps you could make your life count on the mission field, ways to get trained and equipped. So tomorrow's broadcast, I believe you're going to be blessed. Oh, and Thursday, I'm burning with something for Thursday, Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So glad to be with you these hours, have them together. Again, the phone number 866-34-TRUTH. All right, let me give you a perspective on something. It is human nature to procrastinate. It is human nature to make a commitment and not keep it. Part of the fall, all right? It's easier to oversleep than to get up early. It's easier to be lazy than disciplined. It's easier to have a sweet tooth for chocolate than a green tooth for broccoli, whatever you want to call it. It's just human nature. So to live a holy life, to live a godly life, you have to swim against the tide. Look, it's easier to read a newspaper than to read the Bible. It's easier to chat with someone than to have quality prayer. You know, the spiritual things require a certain exertion. So it's also human nature to deceive ourselves, to say, oh, I'm going to change when this happens. And we really mean it. We think we really mean it, right? Oh, yeah, when I'm married, then I'm going to be more responsible. Or when we have our first child. Yeah, you always think like that. And then you get to that next level and, well, when I'm 40, I'm going to change. 30, not a 40, no, a 50. Now, when I retire, it's always tomorrow. And we can be very sincere about it. We really mean it. But the fact of the matter is that we are deceiving ourselves. Now, look, if I had shared certain things with you 20 years ago, 30 years ago, if I had the insight from the Lord to share with you 40 years ago that certain things that are happening in the culture today would be happening, you would assure me, not on your watch. No, no, no. This could never happen on our watch. No, this is too far-fetched. America would never let that happen, okay? We'd say it, we'd meet it. How many of you are in a condition today, maybe physically with your weight or some other issue in your life or in debt or in some other place, and you would have guaranteed me a year ago or 5 or 10 or 20 that you'd never be in that place, you'd never let that happen, and there you are. I'm not saying this to condemn. I'm saying this to help us wake up to reality. All right, so here is a snapshot on how crazy our culture has become. But by crazy, I mean social and cultural madness. Here's a news headline from Rebel News. Judge bars lawyers for female track athletes from referring to trans competitors as male. There's a picture of three young ladies. And the article goes on to explain there's a case going on in Connecticut. In fact, there are other related cases, okay? There's a case going on in Connecticut right now where attorneys for these three female athletes have filed suit saying it is not right to have biological males competing. So the Daily Wire reported on Monday that lawyers in this particular case, so it is Soule and others versus Connecticut Association of Schools and others, are now calling on District Judge Robert Chattigny to recuse himself from overseeing the case after he chastised them for referring to them by their sex. Quote, I don't think we should be referring to the proposed interveners as male athletes. Oh, okay. So what's the case about? These young ladies, athletes, they run. Now they have to compete against biological males, boys who identify as girls. So let's say they're 16 or 17 years old. Let's just say that. And now they're competing against a boy who's 16 or 17 and who is biologically stronger, faster, because he is a male in good shape. They're females in good shape. He's a male in good shape. All the world records for fastest running and endurance and strength, and they're held by males, okay, because men are physically, on average, bigger, stronger. So the best male weightlifter is going to be stronger than the best female weightlifter. And the best male sprinter is going to be faster than the best female sprinter. Okay, it's not a matter of intelligence or which sex is better than the other, male or female. No, it's just certain things. Men have certain strengths. Women have other strengths. Okay, it's that simple. It says biology is not bigotry. All right, there is a reason. Check all world records. You have men's records and women's records for a reason. You have men's leagues and women's leagues. The very, very best team in the women's NBA would be crushed by the worst team in the NBA, men versus women. You have separate golf tournaments, okay? It's all separate. Why? To be fair. So women can compete against women and men against men. To be fair. It is that simple. So these young ladies are saying it's not fair that we have to compete against men. You know, let's say the top three, whoever medals, is going to get a scholarship into a certain university and be on the track team. And you got two guys competing and the guys win. I mean, this is real life stuff that's happened. So the girls that could have been 1, 2, or 2, 3, now they're out. Maybe one is 3, the other is 4 or 5. They don't qualify. It's unfair. And these are biological males. They haven't even had sex change surgery. They haven't even had years of hormone treatments. They are biological males, period. So here in a court case, this is being discussed, And the attorneys for these young ladies want to point out that these are biological males. They can identify as women. They can identify as ducks. They can identify as Martians. They can identify as anything. They may genuinely in their heart feel that they are men, and they may feel at home saying they're men. They may feel it's psychologically better, but or saying that they're women. But the bottom line is they can identify as women, but they are not women. They are not women. They are men. They are males. So here, the attorneys want to refer to them as males, and the judge says, you are not allowed to do that. You are not allowed to refer to them as males. We must call them girls. We must call them females. We must call them young women. What? This is a court. What kind of insanity is that? My heart goes out to someone who identifies as trans. They would say, we don't need your compassion. Just embrace us for who we are. Well, I'm sorry. A biological male is never going to be a female, and vice versa. And if I really love you, I'm going to tell you the truth, all right? And work with you to try to find wholeness from the inside out, rather than have to be on hormones for life, rather than to have radical sex change surgery, rather than to find yourself 5 years later in deep sex change regret, which happens more commonly than people want to admit. But the fact that the court, the judge, says you cannot call a biological male a male is to show you how far this radical social activism has gone. When I was in England, I was talking to a nurse, and this nurse was telling me that a patient comes in. They're filling out the form about this patient. The patient is clearly, visibly a biological female, and in the past has been in the hospital as a female or the doctor's office as a female, but now identifies as a male. And she said, this nurse said, we are required to put down that if this man identifies as a woman, that he's actually a woman. She said that could threaten the person's life because you might misdiagnose something. Look, this recently happened. There was a man who identifies as a woman and dresses as a woman, goes into an emergency room in a hospital with stomach pains, and they just thought it's some very male-looking, fat woman. Well, it turned out it was a pregnant going in and identifying as a man. That's it. It's just confusing to even sort this out. So she goes in there, pregnant, but dressed as a man. Now I got it right. Dressed as a man, and they think it's some kind of strange-looking, fat man and try to deal with the stomach issues. By the time they realize it's a pregnant woman, lost the baby. Look, women react to strokes differently than men. They affect the brain differently. Certain dosages, certain things you're going to prescribe is going to be different for a man versus a woman. I said, well, what do you do? She said, we ignore the guidelines. We don't tell the patient, but we write down what their biology is because we want to save their lives. They said, but if we're found out, we could lose our jobs. That, my friend, is social insanity. Why do I share that today? Just as another example, so we need to wake up to the fact that we're in a confused world. And if it's not this issue, it's going to be something else. It's going to be some heterosexual issue or some larger societal issue or race issue or something else going on or opioid addiction. We got a lot of issues. This is not just the time to be kind of coasting along, merrily living our lives. It's wake up time, friends. It's a confused world. We, as the salt and the light, should be the ones who make a difference. We should be, as we talk about being for you on the air here, a voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity. What I seek to do on the radio broadcast is to emulate, hopefully, what we should all do in society, and to the society be a voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity. May God help us to wake up to reality, to get serious about being serious. Let our light shine, proclaim Jesus without fear, and help a sick and a hurting world. Come on, start calling. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. We come back. Let's see. I'm going to James and Jason and Gideon and Jeremiah and more. So stay tuned. We'll be taking your calls next. Have you ordered your copy of When the World Stops? Have you downloaded the ebook? We finally found out we're getting the paperbacks in. All of you who pre-ordered, I think a week from tomorrow they're supposed to be in. We'll get them signed, sent out to you immediately. Thanks for your patience. Don't forget the ebook, When the World Stops, Words of Hope, Faith, and Wisdom in the Midst of Crisis. It is on sale on Amazon. Grab it while you can.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire. Welcome to everyone listening by radio. Shout out to everyone watching on Facebook and YouTube. Everyone catching up a day or two later on podcasts, wherever you are taking in the broadcast. Thanks for joining us. Phone lines are wide open. 866-348-7884. I want to dive in and answer a bunch of questions that have been coming in. And we will start on Long Island with James. Welcome to The Line of Fire.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Brown, for taking my call.
You bet.
I have an important question. I think it's important because I don't think the church or too many scholars spent so much time on it, because when I did my research, too much did not come up. But I wanted to ask you, because you are one of my primary source of information based on your study. So that's why I waited to talk to you.
Great.
The question is about Luke 22, mm-hmm. verse 35 to 39. But we're going to focus on verse 38.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm understanding, Jesus was not saying, "Get ready, we're going to fight the Romans when they come get us."
Correct.
Because in verse 38, it says, so that the prophecy could be fulfilled. So what prophecy is that? My research lead me to Isaiah 53:12, when he says he was numbered with the transgressors.
Yes, sir.
So now I was looking to see why was the two, what is the meaning of the two swords? Now what I came to find out is that, I'm not so sure, but so far I'm still doing the research, that in that time, the Jewish people could not be found with two swords. If they had two swords, it would be like a crime. One, it would be like, hey, you're going fishing, so you need your sword to, you know, filangle your fish. But if you got two swords, it would be a crime, and that way he would be arrested. Because when we go to John 19, verse 12, the Pharisees said, if you don't arrest him, then you're not a friend of Caesar, because he marked himself as king. So am I correct in interjecting that the two sword was just so the prophecy could be fulfilled so that Jesus could be arrested? That would be a reason for him to be arrested. Because if it was just one sword, he would be like, hey, they just like knives.
James, where did you find that two swords was a crime versus one sword? What was your source for that?
It's funny. I was looking at it this morning at like 4 o'clock in the morning. I couldn't sleep, so because I knew you was gonna come in on. So, it was somebody that did a paper on it. So I went and registered through this. I think it's jstor.org.
Okay. Yeah.
Where you can read different articles, mm-hmm. and they actually have an article on it. But I don't know if for some reason it's not popping up on my phone. So I said, you know, I'm gonna buy it to read it, because I hate to say it that way, but it's just like that's what the Spirit kind of led me to believe.
Got it. All right. So you're talking about an academic article that was published that made that argument. So
yes.
let me come at this from a few different angles. All right. At first, so everyone knows what we're talking about. These are great questions, James. In
Thank
Luke
you.
22. Jesus is meeting with his disciples. It's after the Last Supper. And he's telling them what's going to happen. Now, we know quite explicitly he did not want his disciples to fight with the sword, right? He was very, very clear about that. And when Peter cuts off the ear of the high priest's servant, Malchus, Jesus reattaches the ear, and he tells Peter, and it's in all the Gospels, put your sword in the sheath. Those who live by the sword will die by the sword. This is not what I want. He tells Pilate, If I was an earthly king, my servants would fight for me, right? So he was certainly not calling for that, nor was he just giving general counsel about self-defense, that you're going to need swords in the days ahead because it's going to be rough out there. Self-defense is a totally separate issue to me, all right? In other words, I'm not against someone having a weapon at home for self-defense, whatever. That's a totally separate issue. But it's not what he's talking about here. So Jesus says, when I sent you out with no money bag or knapsack or sandals, did you lack anything? They said, nothing. He said to them, but now let the one who has a money bag take it, and likewise a knapsack, and let the one who has no sword sell his cloak and buy one. For I tell you that the scripture must be fulfilled, in me he was numbered with transgressors, Isaiah 53:12, as you mentioned. For what is written about me has its fulfillment. And they said, look, Lord, here are two swords. And he said, it's enough. All right, so the theory of Rabbi Shmuley Boteach and following some other Jewish teachers was that Jesus was planning on leading an armed revolt against Rome. Yeah, so with 11 men and two swords, right? But that when they rose up, that then the rest of the people would rise up with them and overthrow Rome. And this is a hint left in the gospel. So I demolished that idea in my book, The Real Kosher Jesus. I completely demolished that idea. I have a whole chapter dealing with this saying here. And saying, no, he's not saying, okay, good, two swords, that's plenty to take on Rome. He's not saying that. And then, again, the rest of the accounts, as you go down, when they come out to, the crowd comes out to get them, and he says, have you come out against a robber, etc. But when it says one of them struck the servant of the high priest, cut off his right ear, Jesus said, no more of this. This is right there in Luke's gospel, right? So he did not want them using swords, or he was not calling for a rebellion. And what I understand the text to me as other scholars do, is that Jesus is speaking to them here with great irony. All right, so your overall point, I'm in agreement with, that he had to be numbered with transgressors. He's got to look like a bad guy here. And he says, hey, the time we're coming in now, you're going to need a sword, you know, and we got two. He goes, oh, okay, enough. I'm talking metaphorically here. I don't mean we actually need to go out and get swords, but I'm going to be numbered with transgressors. I've got to look bad. So, you know, here's the way it happens. Is there evidence that having two swords was different than one? Not to my knowledge. That's probably why this person has written a whole article on it to argue it. In all of the commentaries that I looked at, Jewish background that I looked at when writing that relevant chapter in The Real Kosher Jesus, I never found that myself. Certainly, okay, though, that could be an excuse to say, oh, look, they're armed, because it was the zealots that were known for carrying swords. So the sword did associate you with rebels, with freedom fighters, with people like that. Right. Yeah. So that argument we'd agree with. But Jesus is basically saying, okay, either that's enough, two swords is enough for me to look bad, or, okay, enough. You're taking me too seriously. I'm talking ironically here. But either way, the overall narrative now, it looks like, oh, yeah, we got this guy with his armed thugs. Now, they were coming after him because he was proclaimed king, and that was a threat to the stability of Rome, okay? But your way of the statement, it is enough, meaning two is enough to make me look bad here, that's intriguing. But again, I've never seen it anywhere. So here's what you do. Once you look at that article, take a moment and just shoot a link to our website and just ask to get it to my attention that you're on the air with me and I wanted to see that specific reference. And then I'll see if I can find any other scholars that have argued that. I just never found it with my own research, but there's a lot of stuff out there, and yes, there could be some source maybe that hints at it, and this guy is trying to make that argument. So, yeah, appreciate it, and we're overall in harmony in terms of what actually happened that night.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Brown.
You are very welcome. And look, man, we got to bring on someone from New York to remind you of the proper way to speak English. Yeah. Grew up on Long Island. Okay, 866-34-TRUTH. We go over to Mississippi. Jason, thank you for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, glad to be on.
Great. Go ahead.
Recently, of course, Mississippi is one of the states that's gotten a little more national attention for pressure on closures and things like that. And, you know, many of the protests, we've had a couple in our state. We are a state that has not been as closed as others, and so we've gotten some, you know, different, you know, call about that. Within many of the protests, of course, there have been a lot of jokes that are we more concerned about humanity or economy. And so when many of these protesters have come out, some of the people that have joined them seem to be protesting not necessarily irrelevant things, but not specifically what the protest seems to have been initiated for, which was to take away certain governor's sanctions and say we need to reopen businesses and things like that. And one of the ones that stood out to me were the people who had pro-life signs. So they were going to these protests, joining with the call to reopen businesses, but they were, you know, there to protest against abortion and being pro-life. And before COVID was even an issue, I've always wondered a little bit about this as, you know, as a Christian disclaimer, when people want to say they are pro-life, and then other people go, okay, so that means you don't want abortions, and there's no allowance or even exemptions for choice. But then the same people can be discussed with, and this is not a general statement to apply to everyone who calls themselves pro-life, but many times they say that they don't have a problem with the death penalty, going to war and collateral damage there. Or then when it comes to issues of impoverty, the impoverished who, you know, can't afford things, that, you know, there are a lot of families who can't afford homes, food, and they argue against things like health care and because they cost too much. And it's like, but if you're going to be pro-life, aren't we going to be this across the board, not just for the unborn?
Right, right. So like Jason,
all life.
Yeah,
but here's the current ones, the reason I want to tie it into this more specifically is those who join on reopening businesses because they argue that it's hurting the economy. And unfortunately, some people think this is the pandemic is a fake, but there are issues of COVID that need to be addressed, and the government's trying to figure out how to do it. But when they join and say that they are pro-life, I'm thinking, you know, as far as the principle of doing unto others, then you would want to help protect many
people. Right. No,
I
understand. So, right. So let me help sort this out. Number one, I don't know, and you don't know, each individual protester and what's on their mind and why they're doing what they're doing. But let me lay out a few specific things, and then I'll come back on the other side of the break. Number one, many would say it's not a matter of caring for humanity or caring for economy. They say if the economy tanks, that's going to cost more lives than the virus. So many genuinely believe that. The other thing is, the reason that many pro-lifers will agree with the death penalty is because they make a distinction between taking the life of someone who willfully took the life of someone else and thereby esteeming life versus killing an innocent person. Anyway, I'll finish on the other side of the break. Stay right there.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us, 866-34-TRUTH. So, Jason, it's possible that some of the pro-lifers are also Republicans, likely that they are, and that they hold to a larger Republican platform without thinking it through. But most that I know that have thought through the Republican platform say that the Obamacare or Democratic health care plans or what Bernie Sanders is advocating is actually in the worst interest of people and will hurt people more than help them, that the pro-life folks I work with are very much holistic. In other words, they are looking for what is in the best interest of people from the womb on, and they hold to these particular positions. Now, those that oppose them will say, here, for example, going to war, all right? If you go to war and take out ISIS, and ISIS has been butchering people and destroying lives and capturing girls and raping them and committing every kind of unimaginable atrocity, and you can take them out, you've done a good thing. You've done a pro-life thing.
Well, I want us really to go to that edge because, of course, ISIS wasn't able to do those things until after our invasion.
No, here's my point. Here's my point. You asked me for a perspective, right?
Right. That's the perspective. I don't really want us to get into Middle Eastern, and I don't want to talk about certain politicians necessarily as far as Republican versus Democrat.
Well, but Jason, okay, here, I'm trying to help. You asked a question and you mentioned health care, you mentioned war, you mentioned death penalty, you mentioned poverty. So I'm responding to these things, saying that's why people could be out there being pro-life. I have had economists tell me that if we don't get the economy rolling quickly, this is almost a month ago, that more lives will be lost. There's an argument now from World Health Organization where they have said that because of the economic shutdown, instead of 130 million people facing poverty, facing starvation in 2020, which was the number in 2019, it could be 260 million, double that number. No matter how many the virus kills, it's not going to go anywhere near that. So people try to balance these issues out. And the best thing to do is to find out from the pro-lifers, hey, why do you feel the way you do? And you'll often find out they are very holistic in their thinking, but just have a different perspective on these issues. Hey, Jason, just trying to help you understand why they could be out doing what they do. Again, I don't know each individual one, but that would be some of the explanation. You can be pro-life and pro-death penalty. You can. Because you esteem the value of a human life, and you quote Genesis 9:6, where God says, whoever sheds human blood, by man shall his blood be shed, because in the image of God, human beings were created. All right, thank you, sir, for the call. 866-34-TRUTH. And we go to Florida. Gideon, thanks for holding. You're on the line of fire.
All right, thank you, Dr. Brown. It's an honor to talk to you. I have to say that your ministry impacted me a lot since I moved to the U.S. I want to say thank you, because I never had a chance to say the same thing to Ravi Zachariah, but I have the honor today to say thank you.
Well, thank you, sir. What country were you born in?
I'm from Haiti.
Haiti, okay. Well, so glad to have you here with us. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. My question is, in a video that you posted before about our children are being punished for the sin of their parents, I heard your answer in this video, but I would like to know, how do you see the story of Achan in Joshua chapter 7? Because of his sin, he was destroyed in his whole family. And also for King Ahab, who was evil before the Lord, and Jehu was a chosen one who killed all King Ahab's sons. So it seems like the sin of the father in these two stories have been impacted, or God punished the children. So I would like to have your perspective on these two stories as well.
Yes, a very, very legitimate and important question. So I was asked about that. Does God actively punish the sins of the children, the children for the sins of the parents? And I said, it's not that, but it's really that the sin of the parents is now visited on the children. That, in other words, if I have been a terrible father, an alcoholic, abusive father, and raised my children in that environment, that and I don't repent of that, and then they grow up and they don't repent of that, that now the thing is multiplied. The consequences of the sin are passed on. But what about times where there's actual punishment? Now, look, it may be that Generation A commits such terrible sins that judgment falls, because of which Generation B is raised in exile. So the consequences can be passed on. But in the cases that you mentioned, there are a couple of possibilities. One possibility is that a parent's sin can be so drastic that everybody pays for it. So, for example, a father gets into a furious fight with his wife in the car, got the kids in the car, he gets so outraged, he just drives off a cliff and kills everybody. So everybody suffered for his sin, but God did not specifically judge them. They just suffered as a consequence. The cases you make are more of divine judgment. So here's the possibility, sir. What if Achan's family knew what he did? In other words, Achan comes and does that and hides things in the tent. Did the whole family go along with the cover-up? I mean, the way God wanted it in Israel is if your brother is an idol worshiper and trying to lead the nation into idolatry, you need to go public with it. Maybe the whole family was complicit. That's one possibility. The possibility with the sons of Ahab is they continued in the father's sin and therefore were visited by that judgment. Would God have spared it if one of them had been deeply repentant? You would think so. You would think so that God would have mercy. It's not to say that there will never be judgment on the next generation as a consequence of the parent's sin, but it's not the rule. And again, Israelite law was you cannot put the sons to death for the sins of the fathers. So the consequences of the sins can be felt. The next generation, if my generation was totally wasteful, destroyed the environment, put our nation into massive debt, my kid's generation is going to grow up under the weight of that and can suffer some of the consequences. So in short, there could be rare cases where the sin is such that it brings generational judgment, it affects everybody, or it could be that the next generation didn't repent, didn't do what was right, and therefore fell under the guilt. And that could be the case with both of these.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And you mentioned Ravi Zacharias. In the natural, he's at the end of his life, but God can work a miracle and preserve. He's been such a great example, such a statesman and prince for so long. So may God's mercy be manifest in his body. Thank you, Gideon, for the great question and for the kind words. All right, let's see. We've got time for another question or two. Jeremiah in Texas. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, sir. My question has to do with 1 Corinthians and when Paul was talking about some of them were formerly such and such, and one of them was murderers, another one was thieves. If that would have occurred in today's climate, with especially in a country like ours, would they, in their time, as far as when I say church, would they have been viewed as protecting or hiding criminals?
Yeah, so let's say you had someone who had been a thief and now gets saved, and now they confess, hey, I was a thief, I did X, Y, Z. Should they have gone to authorities? Murder? Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing is many of us did things before we were saved. When we got saved, we were clean, went on with God, and it didn't dawn on us, well, hey, you know, when you did that drug deal with that person, you ripped them off. You charged them twice with it. You know, you need to go back and make restitution to that person, you know. But yet you might have said, I stole from people. So some things are going to be more in a gray area. You know, if you just robbed a bank and you keep some of the money for yourself and not for the other guys, okay, so you turn yourself in, but do you now go back in front of the other guys to split the money? Obviously not, you know. So there are people that are involved sometimes in, like, terrorist activity in a country, and it's just like there's war. Everybody's killing everybody, and there's no standard. Now you get saved, so you break away from it. You try to do good. But I imagine that if someone had broken the law and came to faith and said, hey, I was the one guilty of thus and such, then that person would be expected, and the church would be expected to turn that person over to the authorities. I would imagine so. If there was a situation, I say imagine so because I just don't know everything the way it would have happened in Corinthian culture. If someone had killed, if it was outright murder, then yeah, you would have to go to the authorities. If it was the kind of thing where, here, Saul of Tarsus, right? He didn't go to the authorities. So he got radically saved and God didn't tell him to go to the authorities. He thought he was doing his religious work and did the right thing and it was wrong. So in many ways and situations in the world, that's not how it works. But certainly in our case, if someone came, got saved, said, hey, I committed this.